Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
So it's my great pleasure today to introduce three amazing writers who write short stories and all kinds of amazing things. I'm going to start with Naomi Williams. Naomi was born in Japan and spoke no English until she was 6 years old. Today, she lives in Davis, California, where she teaches creative writing and serves as co-director of the literary series Stories on Stage Davis. She is the author of Landfalls, a wonderful novel that was long listed for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize and the National Books Critics Circle John Leonard Award. Her short fiction has appeared in lots of amazing journals, but most importantly, in one story. right here, Snowman. She's a five-time Pushcart Prize nominee and one-time winner. She has an MA in creative writing from UC Davis. To her left is the wonderful Karen Shepherd. She is Chinese-American born and raised in New York City. She is the author of four novels, An Empire of Women, The Bad Boy's Wife, Don't I Know You, and The Celestials, and the forthcoming collection of short stories, Kiss Me Someone, which will be out in September. Her short fiction has appeared in also many wonderful journals, but most importantly, one story. And she teaches writing and literature at Williams College in Williamstown, Massachusetts, where she lives with her husband, Jim Shepherd, who is to her left. Jim Shepherd is the author of seven novels, including most recently The Book of Aaron, which won the Sophie Brody Medal for Achievement in Jewish Literature from the American Library Association and the Penn New England Award for Fiction. He also has written five short story collections, including his newest, The World to Come. Five of his short stories have been chosen for Best American Short Stories, two for the Penn O. Henry Prize Stories, and one for a Pushcart Prize. He teaches at Williams College with Karen. And most importantly, they have three beagles.
Three beagles.
Three amazing beagle dogs, which is really the true topic of this panel. So we're here to talk about short fiction. I'm going to give just a little bit of an overview about one story to start us off. So One Story is a literary magazine that publishes one short story at a time. And I founded it with Mary Beth Boccia about 15 years ago. And at the time, one of the reasons why we started One Story was in response to the folding of many great lit mags, including Story Magazine, which some of you might remember. Story Magazine was an extraordinary place that was discovered a lot of the biggest voices in literature today. They published Junot Diaz first. They published Nathan Englander first. They published Edwige Dondecott. And when Story folded, Mary Beth and I were concerned as citizens of literature that there were fewer and fewer places between the very small university literary journals that are wonderful but usually have a very small circulation of just a few hundred readers, and the very large periodicals like The New Yorker or The Atlantic Monthly or Harper's. So there needed to be more stepping stones, we felt, of magazines that were somewhere between those two, that came up more frequently, that had a robust readership and strong supporters. And at the time, we felt we wanted to start a literary magazine that would be focused just on short stories and treat all writers the same. We are the only literary magazine that has the rule that we publish an author only once. So we're actually working on issue 235 right now, and we've published 235 different writers from around the world. And each one is treated exactly the same. It's a very plain, simple, unintimidating format, and it comes out once a month. And we found very quickly that there was this hole in the marketplace because we thought this was going to be a zine that maybe 20 of our friends read. But because what we were doing was so unusual, it took off in an interesting way, and we now have over 15,000 subscribers and readers reading each story each month, which is a wonderful exposure for many of the emerging writers that we are showcasing, and then we put them side by side with well-known writers like these ones up here, and also people like Ann Patchett, Joyce Carol Oates, and it's a lot of fun. It's a labor of love. I'm sure we'll get to this, but nobody's into short stories for the wild fame or money. We're in it for the art. We're just a slight step, you know, slightly step above a larger audience than poets. So, you know, everybody is in it for the love. But so I'm really excited to be talking to three extraordinary short story writers that I've had the honor to work with at One Story. And I thought I'd just start the conversation by talking about what is a short story in the first place. And I pull some great quotes, and one that I really love that Laurie Moore uses often is, she says, a short story is a love affair. A novel is a marriage. So I'm wondering if each of you could sort of give your thoughts if you had to describe what a short story is.
Does that mean a short short's a one-night stand?
Yeah.
And what is a prose poem? Yeah. Then? Yeah. The mind reels with possibilities.
Yes. I think a prose poem is a truck stop.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Well, we're finished here.
Okay. Kind of depends on the marriage and the affair, I think, right? For that Laurie Moore thing to work.
That's true. Well, actually, another person, another great description of a short story, actually, that Elizabeth McCracken gave at right before she won the Story Prize, which is a award that Jim also won. She was describing it like a diorama. And she said a novel is like a diorama that you go to at a museum where it's all the sort, it creates this illusion of depth and transportation, and you've got the stuffed animals and you've got the paintings on the walls and you've got, you know, all these different elements that are, you know, to create the sort of like false feeling that you're somewhere else, that you're experiencing another part of the world. And she said, a short story is like half a duck that's like stuck on the wall, you know, that sort of gives that illusion. So it's like half of it's real and half of it's, yeah, you know. And she said that's was her different sort of description of what a short story was, which I thought was hilarious.
Well, I think one of the things that draws me to the short story, besides the opportunity that it affords to be at the white hot center of American culture, is that ability to just drop into the middle of a world without doing anything of what I think of as that furniture moving that's involved in big novels, you know, that sort of let's set up the entire. I think the extreme version of this for me is the James Michener novels, where it's sort of like, you know, the novel's called Texas, and it begins, you know, the rocks that form the geology under Texas, and you're like, oh my God. We have like 100 pages before we're getting to the protagonist, yes, essentially, you know. And one of the things I love about short stories is the way you have to hit the ground running, and you're dropped into the middle of the situation, and you're also dropped into answering that question that's so crucial, I think, to the literary reader, which is, why am I reading this? Why is it important? You know, you're stopping my life to make me engage this, so why, essentially? And you have, there's a greater urgency, I think, to the stories that I admire in terms of the way they drop you into that. Well, that shut everybody up.
Okay, Karen.
Oh, we're going in a row?
Yeah, yeah, okay. Just tell me, this just to start us off.
Well, I listen to Jim say that, or I listen to what Elizabeth McCracken or Laurie Moore says, and I agree, and then I immediately think of all the exceptions to that. So, mm-hmm. You know, you think of a novel like Silk, or a tiny, very economical novels that would argue with what Jim just said about what a novel is. Or you think about maximalist short stories like, you know, some like Jim writes or Andrea Barrett writes, where there are whole worlds with lots of furniture moving right. going on in them.
Turns out it's a continuum.
Yeah, exactly. Turns out you're just wrong, yeah. honey. So,
which will become the theme yeah. of the panel.
No, so, and I'm thinking about the diorama. So I grew up across the street from the Museum of Natural History. So I feel like dioramas were a huge part of my childhood. One thing that I do think I loved as a child was I loved miniature things. I loved dollhouse furniture. I loved little tiny glass animals. I loved real world things in miniature. And that's slightly different than the kind of big dioramas that you get at, say, the Museum of Natural History. Instead, it's those little, I still love these, like I troll Etsy for little dioramas of worlds. And for me, a short story is a little bit like that. But as Jim would say, even a slice of that tiny world. So there's this sense of being dropped into an already existing world. I do agree with the off-and-running sense of it. I want to start as late in the action as possible in a short story. I want it to be a kind of need-to-know basis, like, come on, you're going to ride shotgun with me, and I'll let you know what you need to know as we get there, mm-hmm. you know, right? So it's kind of like you're going to a cocktail party with somebody, and you say, I really want you to meet so-and-so, this guy there, he's great. Here's what you have to know about him. A lot of mommy issues, you know. Or here's what you need to know about him. He's drop dead gorgeous, and that makes him really arrogant. Or here's what you need to know about him. That kind of sense. And in novels, I feel like I spend a lot of time figuring that out as I go in a novel. And obviously, there's a lot of revision that goes on. But in a short story, I feel like some of that thinking happens before I even start writing first drafts. There's that sense of I know the situation a little better than I might when I start a novel. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I really like the Laurie Moore thing, because when I was working on my book, which felt like a marriage, it lasted for 10 years, so it was like a first marriage, maybe. But I occasionally just I'm 30 years into my first marriage. But I occasionally felt like I needed to cheat on the larger project just to stay sane. And those were short stories. Those were always short stories. And I, you know, sometimes an idea would come to me, and I would just have an intuitive sense that this was short story material rather than novel material. And I think often it had to do with not necessarily that the world or the situations were smaller, but there was some kind of scale issue, maybe, where it felt like, you know, I think I can tell the story in 10 pages. And then I'm very long-winded, so it'd often be 30 pages, and then I'd be hacking away at that to get it down to 10. I don't know how people do flash fiction. I just can't. Every time I think, oh, that's a good idea for a short, it turns into this like 5,000 word thing. But I do feel, I mean, I you know, for the writers out there, I do feel like we get this intuitive sense, like, okay, this is a big sprawling intergenerational saga. This is clearly not a short story. And then sometimes you said, oh, this is about a moment of realization in someone's life. This is obviously a short story. So I don't know.
Well, there's that sense of applying pressure to a situation that you're talking about in terms of scale. I think for a story, there's a structural parallel for the writer that there is, you know, there's a parallel to the emotional situation you're putting your characters in, which is, I want to see how these characters are going to behave in crisis, right, under pressure, emotionally. And to do that, I'm going to do that structurally for myself as the writer. So I'm going to only give myself 10 pages or 20 pages to apply that pressure that is a mirror version of what my characters are going through.
You also, the ruthlessness that you're supposed to, I think, evince as in any kind of writing, right? Does this really need to be there? Mm-hmm. Is amped up in the short
yes.
form, right?
There's a great Joy Williams quote, which is, a novel wants to befriend you, a short story almost never.
Yeah.
Ooh. And I think that leads me to something I want to discuss, which is the risks that you can take sometimes in the form of a short story that maybe you couldn't in a longer form, you know, and that risk might be a certain tone or voice, right? Or a structural thing.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of gives you the opportunity to almost be a little bit looser with certain rules.
And Joy is, I think, putting her finger on something that publishers are always baffled by, which is why readers are a little more wary, literary readers are a little more wary of short stories. That sense of the novel being more likely to befriend you, I think most readers think that the short story, speaking of that continuum with poetry on one end, that the short story is going to be a little bit more of an intellectual test for them, that mm-hmm. There's a little bit larger a chance that they're going to come out of it feeling a little more baffled or a little more, that it ended a little more obliquely. And you can feel it when you talk to people about stories. There's not only that sense that a lot of people who invest their imaginative time in a world want that world to go on forever. You know, I'm often getting responses to my stories when I get responses to them that are like, oh, that story ended way too soon. And I'll go, thank you. And they go, that's not a compliment. And I'll go, oh, okay. And what they mean is, you know, I just got into that world and then the world sort of stopped. And, you know, it's like if I put all this energy into mapping out Hogwarts, I want 5 volumes, you know, that kind of thing. And the short story is not giving you that. But I think the other thing this short story is not doing for a certain mainstream reader is befriending the reader in that sense of, I'm going to spell out for you where this is going. And that's not a small thing. You know, I think there are a lot of readers who go, I don't need that. Thank you very much, you know.
But also befriending them just in terms, I mean, sort of Venn diagramming into, you know, likable characters or something. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard to spend time with prickly characters for a writer. So to do that over a 400-page novel is a harder task in some ways than to do it for a 20-page story.
Well, that seems like actually a great lead-in.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Karen.
The crowd's going, oh, they work together. This is silly.
totally not planned. But I was wondering, Karen, if you could read a little bit of your story, Girls Only, because it is full of some very interesting but extremely prickly ladies.
It's true.
Yes.
I seem to specialize in extremely prickly ladies.
Prickly is such a nice euphemism. Yeah. Isn't it? That's often what happens. You meet somebody on a bus, you're like, oh, you're so prickly.
So much of my fiction is about combating the reductive notion that when girls or women get together in packs, it's all about sisterhood and support. Those of you who have known girls or women, either being one or have known one, know that sometimes when girls and women get together in packs, bad things happen. So that was part of what the impetus of this story was. And if we get to it, I'll tell you what the further backstory was. But I'll just read the first page or so. It's called Girls Only. One summer when they were all still friends, they were the bridesmaids, determined for once to do their best. Their jobs were to smile and fuss, offer agreement and an extra set of hands. They were to play at intimacy, past and present. They were to overlook that they hadn't been close in any way for the past 5 years. While they believed the bride belonged in their little human pyramid, they also agreed she'd been bottom row. They'd seen the movies and read their Jane Austen, but they understood that this one time they were to be her backup singers, her session drummers. Her beaver posse, Cleo said, on the day they arrived at the bride's childhood home for their week of pre-wedding girl fun. But Cleo had always said things like that. She was spacey and tone-deaf, and since college, could it already be 9 years, she had made her living as an escort. Anna, being an environmental lawyer and a former president's great-great-granddaughter, told her remark was repulsive. Cleo said she had been kidding. Can't we just be nice to each other, she added. Gwen, the Asian, the smart one with a tendency toward the self-righteous and the cruel, the one who claimed she'd orchestrated Martha Stewart's return to greatness after her time in the hole, answered while looking at Cleo's tight mini dress, and she really did have an extraordinary body, which many thought made up for her plain face. Sure, could you teach us how to have sex for money? And she didn't stop there, since it was difficult for her to keep anything of which she disapproved to herself. Is that dress crushed velvet and spandex? She asked. The rest of them refrained from piling on, but Cleo had never been intimidated by Asians or smart people. So she said, some of us can wear it and some of us can't, and gestured at Gwen's waistline and made little pinching movements with her finger and thumb. Gwen responded that she gathered that what Cleo tended to ingest was pretty low on calories. I'll stop there.
Well, thank you. That was lovely. Lovely and prickly.
Yeah. Girls.
Girls only. And I will use this opportunity to say I brought copies of all three of these wonderful writers' short stories, and they are in the front. And when we end, there will be a mad rush, but you should help yourself to not just their stories, but also I brought some other short fiction, all issues of One Story, that are free for you to take. Gosh, the other thing, you know, when you were reading, and I forgot about this, the wonderful thing also about short fiction and about this story in particular is the moving through time in such a compressed place.
Yeah.
And I think that's also something that's harder to do with a longer form.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's one of the breathtaking things that Alice Munro's always doing. Yeah. You know, you'll spend like 7 pages in a 7-minute slot, and then it'll go 35 years later, she was to wonder, and then right before she died, and you're like, oh my God, you know, you just like, you make these geologic jumps in time that are not really prepared for in terms of scale, that are really breathtaking and wonderful.
And then the zeroing on a tiny, tiny moment like this gesture, for example, that somehow makes it all feel so true.
It felt true, Karen.
Yeah.
Girls are terrible to each other. Yeah. It's true.
So thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was great. I want to talk a little bit about personal style. And O. Henry, the very famous short fiction writer, says, I'll give you the whole secret to short story writing. Here it is. Rule number one, write stories that please yourself. There is no rule number two.
Oh, wow.
So do you think that over the years you have all developed a certain kind of style? Was there certain things that you tried out first? And is short fiction, you know, because you're not dedicating 10 years to a project, it takes me a long time to write a short story, but it does, you're not throwing your whole life away on one thing. You can actually maybe try something out or try a voice out or try something. Do you think that it's a good form for developing your own style?
It is. Mm-hmm. I feel like that was the entire project of my book, which says novel on the front cover, lest you be confused, but started out as a collection of linked short stories. And you were talking before about whether you can take risks, and the whole thing was kind of designed. Well, it came out of an interest in a particular historical event, but the way I structured it was basically to maybe allow myself to take a bunch of risks. So each chapter, well, they're now chapters. Each chapter in my book started out as a short story in which I was testing a certain kind of telling and a certain kind of voice. And then, you know, if I didn't like it or it failed completely, it was just one story, mm-hmm. as it were. And I feel like now I've written enough that I probably do have some kind of style that maybe is even recognizable to someone else. But the first 10 years I was writing, I was just trying different things. And I almost treated the projects like little etudes, you know, like in this one I'm going to try first person, and in this one I'm going to try third, and in this one I'm going to try a male voice, and in this one I'm going to try a child, and now I'm trying present tense, and now I'm trying past, and this is epistolary, and you know, I just kind of, it wasn't quite a checklist, but almost, where I just wanted to test everything out, and yeah, that's harder to do in a novel. You can't test out all that stuff in novels unless you're very prolific.
Since we're right at this place, and you've kind of set it up, and I want everyone to hear a little bit of Snowmen, which is the story that we ran of Naomi's, which ended up becoming a part of her novel. Could you read a little bit from Snowmen,
sure.
So we can get the voice of that in the air?
Thank you. I'll just set this up a little bit for people. So this is now a chapter in my novel, which is about an 18th century voyage of exploration. The French sent these two frigates to circumnavigate the world, and they went to all these different places, and one of the places they went to was Southeast Alaska. And something very tragic happened there, and I tell that story twice, one from a French captain's point of view and once from the point of view of a native girl who witnesses this accident. So in this scene, and it's the second one that I'm going to read from. In this scene, she's just relating how these things she calls canoes, but they're actually gigantic ships, right? How they react to their arrival in their bay. The canoes were so large they were like floating villages. The women and children watched from the hill while the men went out to meet them, and they came back with black metal and colorful beads and white food that looked like maggots that no one dared to eat, and told us that it was snowmen. We had all heard of snowmen, but none of us had seen them before except for one of our slaves. He said snowmen had visited his people, and these men in the giant canoes looked like them. And he warned us about a powerful snowman weapon that made a noise like an avalanche and could kill a man a long way off. Grandfather was pleased by the slave's knowledge and told him he would be freed at the next potlatch. Then the ants were unhappy because the man was their best worker and the other slaves were jealous. So there was new unhappiness just hours after the snowmen arrived. But the real fighting didn't start till a few days later. At first, we were all excited. The snowmen moved their canoes to the far side of an island in the bay and camped there. Our men and the older boys followed them during the day, and every night around the fire, they would tell us what they saw. Snowmen climbing glaciers or scratching pictures on funny boards, cleaning the floors of their canoes, or looking up at the sky through hard, hollow sticks. And my brother made us laugh by making schwa-la-la-la sounds to imitate their talk. My other brother asked, "What do snow women look like?" And my uncle said, "They do not have women. That is why they are here, to take our women." The ants laughed and said, "No, they are on a great hunt, and they do not take women on their hunts, just like you." Then father said, "Some of the snowmen go off into the woods with the eagle women on the other side of the bay." And my uncle said, "They are all ugly anyway, the eagle women." And everyone laughed, except for his wife, because she is an eagle. And she refused that night to sleep with him. And then he was not laughing. Thank you.
That was wonderful. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you, Naomi.
Well, you know,
so
I got some the occasional feedback to the story after it came out in one story. And a lot of it was like, so is there a whole novel about this girl? Right? And I was like, no, I'm done with her. Right. The ships move on and there was like a lot of regret about like, oh, but she seems like such a great character, but I knew I couldn't pull that off for a whole book. And I kind of didn't feel like I had the right to either, you know, to sort of adopt this native voice for like an entire book and try to represent that experience. Whereas I felt okay about doing it for one short chapter.
Yeah, what your structure allows is a sort of collision of passing strangenesses, which is really lovely, you know? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yeah.
And it also leads me to another thing that I want to talk a little about, which is about research. Samuel Johnson said, the greatest part of a writer's time is spent in reading in order to write. A man will turn over half a library to make one book. And I felt that spoke to not just your story and your research that you had to do in order to write this book, but also Jim is sort of known as like the master man of research.
Or the guy who never gets out is another
yes.
way of putting it.
So Ken, maybe, or you know, and Karen, I know you've done it as well, particularly for The Celestials, your amazing last novel. So maybe each of you can speak a little bit to using, you know, sort of historical or research and but writing about them in terms of a short piece.
Mm. A lot of my stories begin with my just reading strange stuff and not knowing why I'm doing it. Karen has said about me that I'm the only person she knows who would take a history of the guillotine to the beach. because I did take a history of the guillotine to the beach. And what will often happen is I'll just be reading something because I'll be like, what the F? You know, and I'll be like, how did this work? And sometimes I'll do a lot of that kind of reading and nothing will come of it. And very often, though, I'll be doing that kind of reading and I'll just snag on a human dilemma where I'll be like, you've got to be kidding me. And in the case of the the story that was in one story, I was reading, I think that began with the kind of book that I'm always pulling out of a used bookstore or a library shelf, which was something like, you know, Historic Storms of New England. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'll pull a book like that down and I'll be the only one who's checked it out, you know. Yeah. And that led me to the notion that, reminding me that sort of farmers' lives in the 18th century were wrecked by meteorological things that they had no way of knowing were coming, essentially, and that would be the end of their entire project. And that led me to farmers' journals, which is a staggeringly arcane subject. and the farmers' journals then led me to one woman's journal, a farm wife's journal, and a two-sentence entry that just stopped me in my tracks. That was something like, I think I wrote it down somewhere, it said something like, you know, the usual kind of stuff. You know, today we had corn cakes for breakfast. I mean, it's just stupefyingly banal stuff. You're going through page after page. And then it said something like, you know, my one friend moved away. I'll probably never see her again. Mm. And she was way out on the western edge of the frontier, which was then New York State. And she was, you know, maybe 28, 29 years old. She had made one good friend in her life, and the husband had moved that friend away. And she was thinking, okay, so I'm going to be alone for the rest of my life now. And it occurred to me, you know, I'm drawn to catastrophe as a subject, which used to make me seem like a faintly worrisome fringe figure, but now makes me seem like someone who's just reading the papers. And it occurred to me that it was a nice little education in the scales of catastrophe. You know that a catastrophe can be a very, very small thing, essentially. And that's really where that story...
I want to keep talking about research, but since you've already done, again, set this up, could you read a little bit?
No, I'm afraid I can't.
From the World to Come, which was the story that Jim ran with One Story.
Yeah, this is the very beginning of it. It's in the form of a farm wife's journal, and it begins like this. Sunday, 1 January. Fair and very cold. Ice in our bedroom this morning for the first time all winter. And in the kitchen, the water froze on the potatoes as soon as they were washed. Landscapes of frost on the window panes. With little pride and less hope and only occasional and uncertain intervals of happiness, we begin the new year. Let me at least learn to be uncomplaining and unselfish. Let me feel gratitude for what I have, some strength, some sense of purpose, some capacity for progress, some esteem, some respect, and some affection. Yet I cannot say I am improved in any manner unless it is preferable to be wider in sensation and experience. My husband has, since our acquisition of this farm, kept a diary to help him see the year whole and plan and space his work. In his memorandum book, he numbers each field and charges to each the manure, labor, seed, etc., and then credits each with the value of each crop. This way, he knows what each crop and field pays from year to year. As of last spring, once we lost our Nelly, he asked me to keep in addition a notebook list of matters that might otherwise go overlooked. From tools lent out to bills outstanding. But there is no record in these dull and simple pages of the most passionate circumstances of our seasons past. No record of our emotions or fears, our greatest joys, our most piercing sorrows. When I think of our old farm, I think of rocks. My father hauled rocks for our driveway and rocks for our dooryard and rocks for the base on which our chimney was set. There were rock piles in every fence corner, miles of stone walls separating our fields and stone bridges so we might cross dry shod over our numerous little water courses. Piles of rocks were always appearing and growing, and every time we plowed, we would have a new supply. My first task as a toddler was picking rocks out of the new plowed ground. My father, before his day began, would say to me, "While I'm gone, you can pick up the rocks on this piece, and after you get that done, you can play." And when he returned at sundown, I'd still be in the field, at which he'd pointed, on my hands and knees, in tears, the job always less than half done. I'll stop there. Wow.
Thank you. you know, this is one of the reasons why we made that rule of only publishing an author once, as much as it's, you know, hurts me sometimes because I would love to publish more stories by all of you.
She says that now, yeah.
I mean it. But it's also just in those short, you know, you were each reading about a page or so, but you hear the differences, right, in style and voice and tone, and then they're doing completely different things, but all so beautifully. So thank you. That was
thank you.
That was great. I'd love to talk a little bit more about research just because I think that you've all done it so well, and yet, you know, it's you've somehow distilled it down. So when you've done all this research, how do you decide what pieces to put into a short story?
Mm. Well, I guess I could take that.
Naomi goes, as the most successful.
No, please, no. I could start with that anyway. So I did sort of an excessive amount of research for every short story that then turned into chapters for my book, including for this chapter, Snowman. I really wanted to sort of get things sort of right to the extent that that's possible in fiction or even in nonfiction. But I completely agree with Jim that a lot of the impetus for my stories comes from coming across some kind of an odd little factoid, often in a footnote, right? Footnotes are awesome, are
footnotes
they not?
Footnotes are great.
They
We'd be dead without footnotes.
Yeah. So for this story, for instance, I discovered that not only had the French explorers left some records of what happened when they got to this place that we now call Lituya Bay, and Jim, by the way, has his own story about Lituya Bay called Pleasure Boating in Lituya Bay, which is a great story. You'll
yeah, we got it. This panel has Lituya Bay covered.
This is the Lituya Bay panel.
I'm beginning to feel left out.
Yeah, well, time to write a
Karen did one about bad girls in Lituya Bay.
Yeah. But I learned while researching this that an ethnographer in the early 1900s had gone to lived for a while among the Tlingit Indians of Southeast Alaska, and they had in their oral tradition a story that corresponded almost exactly with the story of the two French frigates that arrived in that place, and then they lost a bunch of people there through a sort of freak accident. So I thought, oh, okay, I need to tell that story from their point of view. They were retelling this story for 200 years. But I did find that I could get very hung up, actually, on things like what kind of silverware might the Frenchmen have used when they stopped in Chile? You know, and I would spend like a couple of weeks doing that because I'm just a giant nerd. And I also liked being the only person in the library who checked something out for, you know, decades. And when I was working on this project, I went to the Tin House Writers Conference. This is in 2007, 10 years ago, and I was in Jim's workshop, where I workshopped the companion story to this, the same Lituya Bay story, but told from a Frenchman's point of view. And he gave a talk there about research and fiction, and I was feeling brave that day, and I asked a question. And I said, so when do you stop doing the research, because I can't seem to stop, and just start writing? And I don't know if you remember this, but you
I'll
said,
never forget it.
Yeah. You said, well, yeah, you know, research is very compelling, but sometimes you have to put on your floaty, Naomi, and just jump into the deep end of the pool and start writing. And I can't tell you how many times I thought of that, like going over some obscure little fact and thinking, it doesn't matter what kind of cheese they ate. I just need to write this scene, and I need to write it today.
Or if it does matter, it'll become clear as you're writing the scene, and then you'll look it up.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, as Naomi's saying, two of the things that research allow in terms of bad habits for writers, I mean, writers love to procrastinate. Oh. And research allows you to go, I need to learn more. Yep. I've just got to get more information before I write. Yeah. And then the other bad habit writers have is we're pack rats. If we have anything that's quasi-cool at all, we're right. Like, I'm using this. I put work into this and I'm using it.
Right.
And you got to overcome both of those impulses. And that means you have to be ruthless. You have to lose stuff that you think, but that's such a great detail. And you go, it's doing the same emotional work as another detail. It's got to go. Mm-hmm. And you have to be able to go, I'm jumping in before I'm fully ready, because as Karen just said, I'm going to gain authority. Mm-hmm. as I go. And in fact, the great doctoral line, E.L. Doctoral, about writing fiction is, you know, you can, writing fiction is like driving at night. You can only see as far as your headlights, but you can go all the way to California like that, you know. And it's only when you start moving forward that you learn what else you need to know. And so you've got to start. And also, it's such an act of hubris to begin with. The idea that you're going to wait till you're an expert in this material is a really good way of saying you're never going to do it, because you're never going to be an adequate expert in this material.
So it's funny too. I have a. I'm just formulating this thought while I'm speaking, might not be very eloquent.
This is going to be a problem.
But I'm thinking about research. So I totally agree with what these guys are saying when it's something based in the historical record, right? But then I'm also thinking about the way research works when it's. When the kernel of the story or the novel is in your autobiographical experience, so if you're, say, writing about something from childhood that happened or something like that. I find myself actually resisting finding out more about the autobiographical experience than I would if it were a historical period. So for Celestials, the novel Celestials was based on a historical event, and I did as much research a fraction of the research that Naomi and Jim have done. But say Girls Only or my novel Don't I Know You was something that both based in events that either I had heard about or experienced as a kid. And in that case, I didn't want to know more about the real event. So I didn't do Don't I Know You was based on the murder in New York in the 70s that happened to an elementary school classmate of mine. His mother was murdered in New York in the 70s. And I knew that it happened. We were all told as seventh graders that this had happened. But I didn't, when I was working on the novel, go back through the newspapers to find out what had actually happened to. I have no idea whether my imagining of it is what actually happened. In Girls Only, I heard this story from the woman who helps clean our house in Williamstown. Her daughter, many years before, had lived with two 20-something roommates in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And a guy had come into their house. They sort of knew him. He said he needed to use the phone. And he came in at like 5 in the morning, and he brutally stabbed my housekeeper's daughter like 19 times. And the other two women, it was like a Kitty Genovese thing, the other two women were in their bedrooms and didn't go for help and didn't call for help. And he left thinking he had left this woman dead. And she crawled to the phone and called for help. The two other girls, when he left the apartment, fled the apartment. And he was caught because he came back when the ambulance came. He came to sort of oversee look at the ambulance coming back. And then the two girls, the roommates, said, that's him. They identified him. But what really, obviously what got me was, how do you go on if you're those two girls, right? But they went on, sort of, as friends. So they went to visit her in the hospital. She survived. She's okay. I mean, unbelievably, she survived. And when they went to visit her, I said to my housekeeper when she told us this story, I said, what did they say to her? How did they explain their behavior? Because that's what you're looking at as a fiction writer, is how did behavior like this happen, right? And they said they didn't hear anything. And the girl, the victim, chose to believe them on, because it was easier to believe them. So in that case, what I started with was, can you imagine being those two girls? And can you imagine being the victim, knowing what you must know on some level, that they did hear you, right? Mm-hmm. And I didn't then go look up court records about that case. I didn't, talk to the daughter. I didn't, ask the housekeeper any more information than what she had already told us. So there's something different, I think, that happens with research. You don't want to be bound by the autobiographical.
It makes me wonder whether or not, like, that's the reason why that was a short story and not a novel, because it could have been a novel. Like, I mean, there's been many novels that based on less.
Right.
That I have read. And that's actually leads me to a question, which is, how do you know, you're all talking about how you come across something that strikes you, something you've read, something that's happened to someone you know, and it sparks the impetus to write. So, like Jim, you were talking about how you were reading those journals, but it wasn't until you reached that line of, my friend moved away, I'm never going to see her again, and there was the story.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you know when you do stumble across something that it is a short story and not a novel?
Well, I've really made the short story my default position because it pays so much less. So if I can do a short story, I will do a short story. And in fact, I have a good friend, Ron Hansen, who once saw my research folders for a story that I'd been writing about the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. And he said, "You're insane. I could get a trilogy out of this." and I think, you know, in some ways, I'm kind of dedicating to put less food on my children's table, if that's it. But I'm also attracted to the form, as we were saying. And there, usually I'll think, going back to what Naomi was saying, I'll think, can I do this in 40 pages? Can I do this in 30 pages? Can I? And even my most recent novel, The Book of Aaron, I thought when I first started imagining it, I thought, well, maybe this is going to be a long story. Which, again, is a literary form that makes your agent just put his head down on the desk.
So what made The Book of Aaron, what made you make that a novel instead?
Well, once I decided that I was going to take my protagonist from his earliest childhood all the way to essentially the gates of Treblinka, I thought, you're not going to be able to do this in under 70 or 80 pages, which is an untenable length. And so then you're thinking, I am just sufficiently non-perverse enough to go, well, maybe it's a novel, idiot, you know, or something like that, and then let it get a little bigger, essentially.
This wouldn't be a panel on short fiction if we didn't talk about, two things I just wanted to touch on before we run out of time. One is the MFA short story. And Flannery O'Connor said, so many people can now write competent stories that the short story is in danger of dying of competence. and this is something often that, you know, at one story we get, you know, maybe 15,000 stories a year, out of which we're choosing 12 to publish. And there are just so many talented writers out there. And then the question becomes often that I get as an editor, which is, how do you choose? How do you choose among that? And I feel like there are a lot of, actually Rob Spillman of Tin House has a great metaphor for this, which he says, because of the proliferation of MFA programs, which normally in workshops, what they're doing is short stories, you know, to sort of learn the ropes of writing. A lot of writers out there learn how to build a really good table. And by that, he meant sort of, if you think about it in terms of like, if these people weren't writers, if, you know, they were woodworkers, they are learning how to build a table. And they, you know, it has four legs and it doesn't wobble and it's solid. And you're reading the story and you're like, this is a really solid table. Like, I could eat my dinner on this table. But then every once in a while, you come across like an artisanal an extraordinary piece of work, a table that is, you know, beautifully, you know, with tiger's eye wood or something, you know, or polish, or sort of like, you know, and then you're like, oh, there is, right. You know, that's something that's moving beyond just a solidly built story that has a beginning, middle, and end. So can you talk a little bit about that since you all teach writing? Is there a danger of too many just well-built tables out there?
You know, we all pile on the MFA programs for various reasons, but if, in fact, we're in a position, and I think we are, where literary readership itself is shrinking, and if you imagine readership as a pyramid, and maybe at the top is, you know, really arcane poetry, and at the bottom are, like, stop signs. You know, everything, the entire pyramid is shrinking, I think. And one of the things MFA programs, if MFA programs are supposed to be cranking out writers who can make a living at writing, then it's a staggering pyramid scheme. Mm-hmm. But if they're supposed to be producing readers, if they're supposed to be producing people who appreciate literature, then it may be, in fact, a very valuable service that they're performing. And so it depends on how you're looking at it. But yeah, there's an army of people out there who can do a pretty decent short story at a time when there's almost no magazines other than One Story publishing short stories. So in terms of a business model, it's a dismal failure. But in terms of the contribution to the culture, I'm not ready to write it off quite yet.
Well, maybe not to hit that too hard, and maybe give some things of what makes the magic then? you know, because you read a lot of, you're reading a lot of stories too. So what makes a short story move beyond a solid table? Like what is, you know, and also when you're writing it, you know, you're writing it and the story maybe isn't working for a long time. And then you find that one thing that kind of moves it.
Yeah, you know, you were mentioning before the personal style thing. A lot of times it's the embracing of the idiosyncrasy. It's the embracing of your own weirdness. You know, the table part of it is the craft part. You know, I learned how to do a beginning, a middle, and an end. But it's only really when you take stock of how messed up you really are internally and you start to sort of say to yourself, well, you know, going back to that original quote you had, well, I like this. I don't know if anybody else is going to like it, but I like it. And that you start to get at what's going to make you a little bit more odd than, you know, sort of stand out in some ways.
I think, you know, so for example, at Williams, where Jim and I both teach, you know, we often we're picking our students for classes from writing samples, and we're never looking for a table yet, right? Because these are often intro classes. Right. But we are looking for, you know, someone who has a slightly particular, weird, idiosyncratic way of looking at the world and might have reflected that in one sentence in a 10-page writing sample. You know, so if you think about, say, a Karen Russell sentence or an Angela Carter sentence or something, or a Donald Barthelme sentence, you go, wow, that is a really particular way of looking at this world and describing it. And I think I also teach nonfiction at Williams, and I think what happens amongst the nonfiction students is this sense that the story carries them more than the way it's told. And so if I have a great story, if something dramatic happened to me, I get a free pass on how I put the sentence together. And that's something that I think MFA programs or undergraduate programs in writing can help combat, which is the sense of, no, actually, you make a table out of words in this field, right? Mm-hmm. So you better have a beautiful, you know, not necessarily beautiful, but a sentence that no one else can write, you know? Mm-hmm.
I don't have an MFA. Mm-hmm. I only have an MA. And I don't teach in an MFA program. I've only taught undergraduates and community, you know, like in community writing. I know what you mean about sort of the MFA story. I just recently judged a contest where I had to go through, it was an insane number of short stories, just crazy. And, you know, so, and what I was hoping was that, you know, maybe three of them would be excellent and the rest of them would be bad, right? And that would make my job very easy. But that wasn't true at all, right?
Yeah.
Many of them were good. So, but it was true that a few stories just floated up to the top of my attention. And in those cases, I did feel like there was this perfect marriage of a compelling story with a compelling voice. That, and it was the stories where when I got up the next morning, I was still thinking about that story. And the other ones, there were many that I sort of scored them as I was reading them, and I'd go back and look at the ones that I'd given a 90 to, and I'd be like, well, but what was that about even? And I wouldn't be able to remember, right? Whereas there were stories that I had read even at the beginning of this months-long process that I could still remember because they burrowed so deeply into my mind. And they weren't necessarily the stories where the most dramatic and outre things had happened. It was often the language, or there was a character, or there was something that was that just really stood out from them.
Mm-hmm. For me, I'm looking as a reader for the things that where when I come out of reading them, I don't just believe the things I already believed, that my sense of the world or how humans interact with each other or what the costs of interacting with each other are, it has been shifted in some way. And that's probably going to be an uncomfortable experience in terms of reading something like that. So in other words, if I can go into a story or a novel and come out feeling like I wasn't asked to be uncomfortable in any way, it's probably not, I'm not going to score it a 90. Mm. In other words, I want that sense of, that hurts to think of the world differently or to think of my role in it differently. Mm. I want to be, you know, I want to maybe believe that I have to believe something I didn't believe going in, mostly about myself. I mean, not about the world, but mostly about myself.
George Saunders has a great quote where he says, "What I want is to have the reader come out just 6% more awake to the world." Like, that's his goal, that's for someone to finish the experience of reading a story. And I will say that wonderful things that I love so much about individual short stories is you can have a complete artistic experience in about 15 or 20 minutes, which is hard to do. You can't sit through a play for that. You can't read an entire novel. You can't even watch an entire movie in, you know, unless it's a short short. But there is something about being able to have, you read it all the way through, you know, and have that transported moment when you're reading it that makes short fiction so extraordinary and so special and needed to be celebrated in a certain way. I would love for, you know, just because we're getting short on time and I want to have a few questions from the audience. One thing at One Story that we do is for every issue, we do a Q&A with the author and we ask them, what's the best writing advice you've ever received? So, because I'm assuming that people in this audience are working on their own short fiction, could the each of you maybe give a piece of writing advice for short story writers out there, or writers in general?
Sure, I can. Well, I already
Something
gave
that was
you.
Really useful
I already
to you.
Gave you one piece of great advice that I got from Jim 10 years ago and haven't forgotten about putting on your floaty. But the answer I gave back in 2010 when y'all did the Q&A with me is still an amazing piece of writing advice, which came from Eun Lee. With whom I was lucky enough to take a workshop at UC Davis. And she often said in workshop, don't let your character's problems become the story's problems. You know, and often I found that this was a problem in writing that I found in workshops. So for instance, you know, a story might be incredibly confusing, just unnecessarily confusing, and then the writer would say, well, but my character's having a psychotic episode, so the story needs to be really confusing. You know, that kind of thing.
Or the story's really static because my character doesn't want to do anything.
Well, the story's boring because my character hates his job. And I'm like, no, you don't get a pass on that. And I have found that helpful in my own writing sometimes when I'm stuck on something. It's like, you know what the problem is here? This character is arrogant, and so is the narration, you know? So, yeah.
That's good. Karen?
So I've thought of two. I mean, I've gotten lots of writing advice.
You really don't want to ask Karen for advice.
I know. Okay, so one came from Jim very early on. So when I first started writing, I liked to have women who were much kinder than the women I now write about sitting around with hot mugs of tea thinking about things in kind of poetic ways. And Jim put a little post-it note on the side of my computer. This was, I don't know, 25 years ago now, that said, act. And I keep that there. And related to that is, why does this matter? So you're at a bar and you're telling your story to the person next to you on the bar stool, and that person really wants to get up and go to the bathroom and get another drink. And why should that person stay on the bar stool next to you?
That's another autobiographical moment.
Yeah.
I guess I would add to that, one of the things I'm always telling my students is to try and stay connected to the sense of play. You know, understand that you don't know exactly what you're doing when you're doing it, but that you want to be connected to that childlike impulse that allows you to perform even without full authority. You know, the analogy I often give my students is imagine coming across a little girl in the sandbox and saying, you know, what are you doing? And the girl goes, I don't know. And, you know, at that moment you don't go, well, then get out of the sandbox. If you don't know what you're doing, get out. You know, the girl's like, give me a break, all right? And if the girl then says, you know, I think I'm going to build a castle. You don't go, oh, that's original. Nobody's ever built a castle before. Think you're going to build a castle better than anybody? She's like, relax. I'm trying to do this, all right?
That's also great advice. I would add to that, the first draft is exactly that. You should be in the sandbox playing and just figuring things out. Yeah. And that don't expect it to be perfect. And have that sense of play, and also to introduce sometimes like strange things, mm-hmm. like something out of left field can sometimes bring more, suddenly bring a lot of more air, or having your characters interact with something out of left field that arrives can make it really interesting. But then revise, revise, revise. And once you figure out what your story is about, try to start the story as close to that as possible. And my day job has always been in publishing, and reading something they call the slush pile. And the slush pile is basically any unsolicited manuscript that comes in to across the transom. And when I worked at the Atlantic Monthly, this was pre-internet times, so they would bring in these giant mailbags every morning, just piles and piles of mailbags, that we'd have to go through everything that day. And if the story didn't start until five pages in, a lot of times I would never even get five mm-hmm. pages in. Right. So that's was always the advice. And I learned a lot being a reader. And I would suggest, if any of you have the opportunity to read slush or volunteer read for a literary magazine or for a small press, I learned so much about how to write by seeing what not to do. It's like I saw the mistakes and then learned myself how to make that way. And even if you volunteer just for a month or a few weeks to read for someone, it's a wonderful opportunity to read that. So we have time for a few questions. And I will say, what I did was I put aside copies. Whoever asks questions is going to get these three short stories by these amazing writers, which you could even get them to sign. And then maybe Naomi will make you the... Oh, here we go. All right, we've got one. We've got two right up in the front here. Yes, could you... I think there's a mic. You could ask a question.
Thank you, first of all. You're all very accomplished writers, but if you could think back to the beginning of your career and how you developed a sense for when a story is complete.
How you develop the sense of when a story is complete.
I have an answer to that.
Well, go ahead.
Which is, it will often never feel complete. And there are many writers that...
Good news.
Even after they would publish the story, they would revise and do another version. But here's a good rule of thumb. If you share it with readers that you trust, and earlier drafts, everyone's going to kind of agree with what is wrong with your story. Like, they're all going to be like, the father doesn't really work, or the father, I don't understand why the father did that. And you keep working and keep working. When they stop agreeing with what is wrong with your story and start disagreeing with what is wrong with your story. So in other words, one person saying, no, I still don't understand the father. And someone else says, no, the father's great, but you need more dialogue on page three. And someone else is saying, no, no, not more dialogue on page three. You really need to move this whole thing to Alaska, right? Because then it starts being more they're inserting their own, how they would have written your story with those elements, and not actually about how the story. So the closer you get to that, people disagreeing with what is wrong, that's where when you're close to being done.
You realize you're sowing despair here, right?
No. It's a good thing, because it's, you know what, people are always going to find something wrong with what you write, even after it comes out. That's what critics, Amazon reviews, I mean, someone is always going to find something wrong. So you have to reach a point where you're comfortable with letting it go, and you feel that you've done everything that you can.
I once did a book club for the novel Don't I Know You, and the first question at the book club was, would you like to hear what I really didn't like about this book?
Yes.
There's only one way to answer that. Yes, I would.
Yes, I would. That's so why much. I drove to That's your book right. club.
Yes. So here are your... and then we had another question up the front.
Then we need a mic.
Hi, this is a question for Naomi. I was very intrigued to hear that you've written a collection of linked stories, and I'm wondering what is key to write a collection of linked stories, because I'm writing a collection of stories that I want to be linked, and I'm going back and forth about what I need to have them be interconnected.
Well, I'm not sure how helpful my experience will be to you, because the moment I thought of this project, which became my novel, Landfalls, I thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool if somebody wrote a book about this French voyage, and every chapter was actually its own short story told in a different part of the expedition by a different narrator. Wouldn't that be cool, right? And yeah, I actually do think that idea is still kind of cool, and so I did it. But part of it was that I had never written really anything before except a couple of very unsuccessful short stories. So I didn't think I had what it took to write a proper novel, so I just decided to write it as a bunch of short stories, and at any moment I could bail on the project, having written, you know, just one or two. So for each chapter, I was like, well, okay, I'll try this one. I can still back out of it, and at least I'll have two short stories, right, if I don't have a book. So it had a built-in linkage, right, because every story relates to this expedition, right? I'm a great fan of linked short story collections, actually. One that someone recommended to me while I was working on this project is called The Circus in Winter by Kathy Day, and it sort of goes in the past and the present, and it's all sort of set in this town somewhere in the Midwest where a 19th century circus had wintered in the past. But it sort of spans a bunch of time. And of course, Olive Kittredge is a really famous example of a very successful linked story collection.
Anything is possible. Her latest is also linked.
Yeah. I mean, there's many, many great such stories, but I don't know how helpful my experience is, because it started out with sort of this idea for a book, which then I decided to enact as a series of short stories. If that makes sense.
I think it's finding the thread, whatever that might be, whether it's a setting or it's a single character that weaves in and out. Or there's another great collection called Later at the Bar by Rebecca Barry that is completely diverse characters and all over, but she ended up just having them at one point all go to this one bar. It just sort of gave her this.
Rose Ellen Brown's Street Games is all one street in New York. Takes, you know, all the different stories take place on that one street.
A Visit from the Goon Squad is really a collected of linked stories. So this is your gift. And then I have, we're out of their stories, but I have other stories to give people who also ask questions. So do we have any other questions in the back in the purple shirt? Yeah.
Wait.
Oh, wait, yeah, we're recording this, so if you could just hold on a moment. Well, we bring a mic to you. There you go.
Thank you. So one thing that interests me is when authors have a work that's kind of like something they've been working on for a really long time. Like maybe it's a short story that they started on when they were younger and couldn't figure it out and then came back to it. Or maybe it's something they just, you know, couldn't get published for a long time. Do you have pieces like that where maybe something sat, you know, on your hard drive for like years and then you revisited and really finally saw what you needed to do with it? Just kind of those projects that, you know, linger with you and then finally it all falls into place.
Do any of you have an experience like that?
Were you going to?
No, I was going to say I can think of like 8,000 examples of the opposite. You know, it's like I struggle and it never happens.
Yeah. Let me sit here.
I have one example like that. When I was in graduate school, I had an idea for a young couple who discover themselves inexplicably in the middle of the charge of the Light Brigade. And they're moving forward as the charge is unfolding and they're thinking, how did this happen? And I wrote maybe the first three or four pages of it and very much liked the setup. And then I thought, I asked the question that we always have to ask, which is, why would anyone other than a 10-year-old boy want to continue reading this? And I couldn't think of what was driving it. And in fact, I set it aside for years. And I couldn't quite bring myself to throw it out, but I also didn't know what to do with it. And it was only when I had children that the notion of being in the Light Brigade suddenly made more sense. And the story opened up a little emotionally to me when the couple suddenly became parents. And that wasn't so much I needed to figure something out as much as I needed to be a different person in some ways, right? And the good news is, you're a moving target as a human being as well. So something that you started 5 years ago, you're going to be looking at differently whether you want to or not. Mm-hmm.
I think we have time for one more question.
Look, hands everywhere. Tough decision.
I know. And the lady here in the blue, and then anyone else, we'll talk to you afterwards at the table.
What makes for a good short story title? Like, how do you title?
Oh, that's a good question.
That's a good question. Wow.
Most of the short story writers we know ask that same question with a kind of rage-filled despair. Is sort of.
I will say, just from as an editor's point of view, where I've actually worked with writers, and sometimes we've roundtabled and we've changed the title from when it was submitted to us because we're trying to. For example, actually, I was just talking to the writer James Scott, and we just did an interview together, and we had published a story of his maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and he was saying how he's still tortured and regrets and wished that he changed the title of the story. He was calling it The Strings Attached, and I thought it should be called Banjo. And he said, you were right. It's like 6 years later, and he's like, I'm still tortured. I should have called it Banjo. And he said the reason why he was calling it The Strings Attached, because he wanted it to feel literary and...
like metaphoric.
Metaphoric. Yeah, you know, the strings
to go
attached.
For the particular.
Yeah, and I was like, he's like, but everybody would have remembered my story if it was called Banjo. And sometimes I think that you can be stretching too hard for something with the title instead of going for something kind of obvious. So that's my one bit of advice. Sometimes it's going with the obvious thing, or sometimes I think with a title, it's often what you're trying to do is put your finger very lightly on the pulse of the story. What is this story actually really about emotionally? And if you can find a word or a line or a section or an image or something that you can kind of slightly, hopefully, direct the reader. So they're kind of like, they read the title and they forget about it.
It's tonal, right, in that way. I mean, you're really trying to, it's a tonal introduction to the emotional world of the story. So, you know, Girls Only would be very different if I called it Bridesmaids, right?
That's yes. True.
Although that's a good title, too.
You can have that, Naomi. Yeah.
Or sometimes a title is just trying to, so if someone's looking at the table of contents, which story would they read first? You know, right. So sometimes it's a question of trying to grab the reader's attention and take it that way. But anyway.
And tonal is also moving you out of the realm of subject and into the realm of emotion.
Yeah. Right.
So Amy Hempel has a great story about her editor, Gordon Lish, taking one of her stories, which was titled Marriage, and turning it into a story called Murder, essentially. Mm.
Yeah, that's way
And
better.
There's no murder in the story.
Mm. Yeah.
There's just marriage.
There's just marriage.
Yes.
You know, I think the whole thing about the overly literary title can be a problem. I see that in a lot of student writing, actually, the attempt to be sort of clever or literary. And I recently, a couple of years ago, for another contest, I persuaded a young writer to change her title. The story had a very dramatic scene where someone almost runs over an armadillo in the road. And the title of the story was A Clenched Male Fist, right, which is a reference to the Elizabeth Bishop poem about an armadillo, right? And I thought I knew Bishop, but I totally didn't get that. I was like, what's with this title? And she's like, oh, it's a reference to Elizabeth Bishop. But I said, can we just call it Armadillo?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was, I thought, like, just that helped the story a lot. And she was very happy with it.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, but a few things. So again, there are issues of One Story up here that are all free for you to take. We are going to be moving to a table outside here, signing books and having conversations. I have a few more issues of One Story if you, for, you know, miss the purge here up front. Again, I want to thank these three amazing writers for coming and giving us your wisdom today. I want to thank the Bay Area Book Festival for having us and all of you for coming. Let's hear it for short stories.
We will sign anything you've got.
Yes. Yeah.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.